When I started this podcast last year, I had a number of rules that I set out for myself, and among them was a rule that I wasn't going to turn this podcast into a commentary on contemporary events and not to be a current news podcast that would have my immediate reactions to things going on. I'm not breaking that rule, but I am bending it a little bit to talk about what I did last week. Last week, I visited the Living Computer Museum in Seattle, Washington. It was an amazing experience, and I think there's some lessons to be learned. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about history, technology, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Brenda Romero, Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and other platforms who are helping me get my way out of debt. I was invited to speak at the Living Computer Museum for an event that they called Preserve It, which was essentially a combination of workshops and other presentations that both staff and related institutions were giving. And the mission of the Living Computer Museum fascinated me years ago when I was last in Seattle and I visited it. Basically, it's the brainchild of Paul Allen, one of the co-founders of Microsoft, and it was started simply because he had a number of old tapes that he wanted to read, and he was told that none of the machines that could read those tapes still existed. So he threw what for him was probably a small amount of money into bringing back a number of servers and mainframes that had long ago gone out of commission. Things like the TOPS 20, various VAXs, and Control Data Corporation machines. You don't just bring these machines back, either. You have to bring back the environment that'll allow them to run. That means additional power, raised floor, sometimes liquid cooling, and a whole range of maintenance that goes along with it that perhaps only a multi-billionaire can afford. Once he did this, the machines stayed up, and you were able to log into them from the internet. So it was possible to both visit these machines and keep visiting them virtually from anywhere in the world. When I visited the Living Computer Museum in 2012, it was just starting out. It had been around for quite some time, nearly a decade, but it was opening to the public, and there were rooms that I could be taken through that had piles of machines. There were a lot of dreams happening there, collections of teletypes, collections of microcomputers, and the story of the early days of Microsoft up on customized poster board. And even then, there was this ethic that is not everywhere in computer museums and which has survived to the day, which is the idea that computers should be experienced in the now, in real life, not just behind a piece of glass, not just emulated, not just an abstract concept looking at you from a poster or from a book, but something you can sit down at, go through, play with, and experience. Again, when I had gone through the Living Computer Museum a number of years ago, it was mostly a small room you could walk around in and then a whole bunch of machines scattered in warehouses. Not so this time. I flew from New York to Seattle, and I went almost immediately to the museum to get ready for my keynote, and I was just blown away at what had happened to the place in the years since I'd visited. The computer room was still there. It had a few extra machines, and there were still displays that you could look at and play with computers. But the whole thing was now on two floors, actually two and a half. There was a meeting room area. There were workshop areas. There were those museum shelves that they make where you can turn them into any sort of display over the course of a year. At one time, it might be about abacuses. Another time, it might be a self-driving car demonstration. You know, it could be anything people wanted it to be at any given time. They had actually created a 1970s, 1980s basement with working answering machine and telephone that you could call anywhere in the country with. You could sit in a wood-paneled room with low lights and all sorts of artifacts that you could pick up and go through as if you were sitting around in a real basement. There was a multi-console machine sitting on a CRT television. You could play games with people. You could experience a real living room from 40 years ago. And right next to it, a fully functioning arcade with free arcade machines, a neon glowing light, and a payphone that also worked. Next to that, a recreated 1980s classroom with all Apple IIs and a pre-recorded tape of a teacher droning on about teaching BASIC on Apple II. There were lockers. There was a shelf full of books you could read, and while I was standing there marveling, I watched a mother bring in her daughter and explain to her what going to school was like for her when she was her age. Maybe that made me a little more emotional than I'm willing to admit. The museum, which had previously been a middling size, and like I said, primarily one large room, was now a wide open set of spaces that flowed from one to another. There were stairs and elevators going between different sections. There were all sorts of interesting designs in the walls and murals and portrayals of computers playing a part in daily life. There was a display case that had one of the Atari cartridges taken from New Mexico during the dig a few years back. There was an Apple I that you could play with through a remote keyboard. And there was an Alto, a Xerox Alto. And what fascinated me here was that there were two machines side by side. One was an original Xerox Alto with the original parts that you could play on and interact with. And right next to it was the Contralto, which was an emulated Alto that was built in a 3D printer with its own flat screen instead of a CRT and its own stand and keyboard. So here was the original and right next to it, the potential future under an emulated world. Walking around before my keynote, I was just taken with how much emotion I have for the original plastic and metal creations of the 1970s and 80s, you know, let alone these mainframe giants that were never part of my life directly and which I could walk right up to and interact with as they sat there, living, breathing, connected. And it was all being done in the cleanest, most professional way by people who had training in this, who had training in archiving and device creation and programming. The thing about the Internet Archive, and we discussed the differences, is that the Internet Archive doesn't have a lot of people working in what one would think of as library and directory work. It's mostly about development, system administration, keeping those petabytes and petabytes of data up and running for people to interact with. But at the Living Computer Museum, they have a good amount of people doing all sorts of work in cataloging and description and acquisition and making sure that all of the displays are working as they intended to. It's a different world. And more than that, there was an archiving display. That just blew me away. There was a room you could walk into, and on it were shelves and shelves of Ataris and Commodores and Tandys in their original boxes. And there was a flat screen display where you could learn about all the different things that archiving involves and how you do it. And there was even an office right there in a fishbowl that you could watch somebody doing archiving and cataloging in real time. So my keynote was pretty straightforward from my point of view. I just mostly talked about the Internet Archive, what made it happen, how we were going about our problems and what we were trying to solve, and then demonstrating some of the collections and solutions while talking about the pros and cons of our approach. I think people liked it. It went on for about an hour, and I answered a whole lot of questions. And a number of fans and friends came to it, and it was really nice to see them again. Among them is Stephen Jones, who works at Living Computers and was interviewed for the BBS documentary. He's behind the SDF system. There were people who were from the local tech and vintage communities, people who had been working with me on scanning stuff into the Internet Archive. It's really nice to really meet up with people. So at the end of it, we were down to the last few people, and I was discussing emulation and showing how we could emulate all sorts of interesting things. And I noticed that one of the caterers kept hanging around and asking me questions. And he was wondering about my ability to emulate some of the older systems. And he actually wanted to know, how do you find out who made one of these original games? And that's an interesting problem in the case of arcade games, especially Japanese arcade games. The documentation for Japanese arcades of the early 1980s are mostly in Japanese, which means it's harder to search for names. Like, if you want to know who created Mr. Do, or you want to know who created Galaga, you have to search sideways, because it's not just a matter of typing in Galaga creator. So he was really interested in the creator of Galaga, and I showed him who was the managing director, who was the lead developer, and who did the sound. And it was at that point that he introduced himself, and he was the world record holder for Galaga, working as a caterer at the Living Computer Museum while I talked about emulation. You never know who you're going to meet. So when I'm asked to speak at an event like this, and especially one where people either pay for travel or they even pay some sort of honorarium, I consider it part of the deal that I make myself available as much as possible during the time I'm there. So if somebody flies me in for 3 days, if the event is 2 of those days, I will make myself available for those 2 days. I just think it's right. Sometimes I ask them if they want me to be around for some sort of dinner or work meetings or meeting a number of people who are affiliated with their organization. You know, I just consider it an important part of being a good guest is to make myself available, to be there for them. So there were 2 days of talks at Preserve It after I was there, and I made it a point of attending all of these presentations. And I'm under the impression many of them are going to come out. There were presentations about typography and videos and how the Living Computer Museum sees its place in the future. There's actually some really amazing work being done there, especially in a place that I don't normally get a chance to work in, and that's working with old disk platters. A lot of the machines that people think of as being mainframes had these platters of disks that would provide something on the order of a few dozen megabytes into one location. But there are a number of very large platters that were inside of these plastic cases, and decades of use have made them oxidize and in some cases literally crumble if you move them. And the Living Computer Museum is working on a scientific instrument that will read the magnetic signals off of the disk visually using tools and then produce a 1 terabyte disk image that can then be read to turn it into actual data. This is really exciting work. It's not happening in a lot of places. It won't surprise you to hear that I'm getting contacted about really obscure formats and being asked, can I transfer it? And the answer is no. I'm really good with floppy disks now. I'm good with CD-ROMs. I'm good with cassette tapes. But you can only do so much with the equipment you have. And I've been trying to partner with all sorts of people about getting to these formats that are in true danger of going into true oblivion. And to know that the Living Computer Museum is spending all of this time for this really hard to get format, I mean, that's a breakthrough. You see, while it may seem like I'm really steeped in all sorts of vintage computing technology and that there's nothing that I can't deal with and no subject that's outside of my reach, that's just not true. There are areas of expertise that I have. There are people who I know to contact. And a lot of my work is just simply brokering between these different groups. There's people I know for dealing with videotapes and floppy disks and CD-ROMs. And there's all sorts of other media that need help. And I don't know who to talk to. And at this event, I learned of even more options. We are running out of time. I wrote a blog entry a few years ago called Floppy Disks, It's Too Late. And in that, I talked about floppy disks basically being extinct, being either completely unreadable or coming so close to it that we were going to start losing things left and right. And while it turned out that things were a little better than I said in that blog entry, the fact is that a lot of stuff is going to disappear, never to be seen again, if we don't act fast. This year, I'm really focusing on trying to find caches of floppy disks, CD-ROMs, and other media, and just getting it online. We have been really lucky these last couple of years. Thousands of Apple II floppies have been put up, and Amiga disks are being read left and right, and there's all sorts of breakthroughs happening when it comes to magnetic tape and reading things like 8 and 9-track tape. But none of this work can be done unless we are holding the media in our hands. I'm worried, frankly, about caches of data being kept aside while somebody says they'll get to it eventually. Eventually is not going to work with magnetic data. It's just falling apart in our hands. And so I feel like I have to keep beating that drum. There's lots of stories of people finding old user group collections or old computer store bins and being able to turn them into something that they can read from. The fantastic work of the Dumping Union, which is a group of volunteers lightly affiliated with the MAME emulator that go around and buy or borrow arcade boards from collectors and then read the ROM so that we get versions of arcade games for which there may only be one copy extant. These are heroic acts, and they are going on all the time. But it's not enough. It's gotta be more. And there are a number of people who are still in the mindset of holding back and thinking of things in an eBay paradigm, where something that's been dumped is no longer valuable. But as the Living Computer Museum shows, there's nothing like having things in your hand. I mean, emulation work is critical and important, but it doesn't obviate and destroy the value of the original artifacts. We need those artifacts to understand things, but we can't just treat these items like they will be around forever in a day or won't need all sorts of repairs. Speaking of repairs, there was this thing that I saw at the Living Computer Museum. There was a Control Data Corporation mainframe. It's actually Freon cooled, and there were these memory modules. Now, the thing about the memory modules is that they eventually die. And somebody had created, from scratch, a replacement memory module. They had read the documentation and from the ground up created a fabricated board that they had made that would replace the function of a memory module as it died. This was like looking at a true Mr. Fusion from Back to the Future. It was this green item from the 21st century that was running inside of a machine from nearly half a century earlier. It's a miracle that this happened, and I was told that it just worked. Like, the first time they plugged it in, the machine didn't know the difference, and it all just ran. What a miracle. These are the things that just get me out of the bed in the morning. The idea that if we take an effort, if we consider these things valuable, that this history is going to be okay. Visiting this museum was like having my batteries recharged, frankly. I mean, my energy doesn't flag much for this history, but it can be a little bit daunting to feel like I have piles of items to go through, that I have a lot of questions and answers to come up with them. Some of the things that people contact me about, they're basically requests for me to write a historical essay about how to scan, or how to read a ROM, or how to make an emulator work. And it gets you down because it's just a whole bunch of saying the same things to people. To watch a place that from the ground up was building itself to teach, to make people aware, to bring history alive again, and doing it every day, and doing it with a grace and a style that just is breathtaking. Like I said, it recharged me. And if you're lucky enough to be passing through or living in Seattle, you have to check this place out. In my conversations with some of the staff, they told me about how people seem to discover that it exists and they can't believe it's existed for all these years and they haven't stopped by or they weren't aware. Well, let me tell you, it's worth the trip. If you're into vintage computing, it's worth building a flight around. It's that good. And my hope is that the next time I'm in Seattle, that the place will be even more breathtaking. And I'll tell you that it will not be 4 or 5 years before I visit again. So thanks to the Living Computer Museum for bringing me out there, inspiring me, and doing what they do day in and day out, and really making a difference. I will be back very, very soon. This is Jason Scott. You've been listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast. Thanks to James Bakoyanu, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other supporters who help make this podcast possible. Like I said, I normally like to talk about things in the past and bring them together into conclusions and stories, but it was such a great time last week that I wanted to share it. And while it's really good to know about how things used to be, to know that in the present day there's a place like this museum doing this sort of work, I thought the word had to get out there. Too often I find out about things after they're gone. It's the nature of life. You just discover that there was a really cool thing going on, it ended, and then years later I find an artifact, a printout, or some story about it existing, and I'm sad. But to see what they've done, it just blows me away. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next week.